It's the 11th of February 2009 and I'm at the home of Stan Kirkpatrick in Waverley, which is a suburb of Dunedin in Otago in New Zealand. So I'm a long way from home.
You certainly are, Linda, but you're very, very welcome here.
And it's a
pleasure. Thank you for coming.
It's a pleasure to be here. Now, could we begin at the beginning, Stan, if I could just ask you where you were born and when you were born?
Yes. Well, I was born in Perth, Scotland, on the 3rd of August 1925, which means I'm now into my 84th year. And I've lived in New Zealand now since 1952, when I first came to settle here. And I've married here, and I have two children, and life is just very pleasant in old age.
And you've kept a Scottish accent.
I don't think you ever lose your mother tongue. You never lose it.
Can I ask you, you know, how do you feel now? Do you feel Scottish still? Or
no, that has gone. People have said to me, why don't you go home for a trip? And I'd say it would be a punishment. And they look at me, they're rather amazed at that. But I was at sea for a number of years. And going back to Scotland after long trips abroad, I found that I was a stranger in my own country. I'd grown away from it. A little village, I didn't know a soul there, and mine was a generation that was well scattered by the war. So that I found very, very little of interest in Scotland. And my final leave there, my mother had said to me, look, you have been home, I think, for something like 14 or 15 years for Christmas. Would you stay for Christmas? This was September 1951. And I said, yes, I will do. And in fact, the year moved on, and I decided by this time to come to Dunedin to settle, but was finding great difficulty getting a passage out here. There were no passenger ships then, no aircraft, long-range aircraft. So getting out was a very, very difficult operation. And I had gone round shipping companies endlessly, and with some of them, new building of ships in the Clyde, I went to all of these ships to see if there's any chance of getting a job going out. And I can remember being climbing a huge long ladder down to an engine room on a ship in Greenock, and the chief engineer standing by the vessel, he said, what can I do for you, son? And he said, I said, well, I'm looking for a trip to New Zealand. He said, look, I've got a forecastle full of master's tickets at the moment. He said, there's no way I could give you that. So in the finish, it got near Christmas week, and the company I'd been with was originally a Scottish company, Bankline, of Glasgow, and their head office was then in London, and the chief superintendent rang me and said, are you still looking for a passage to New Zealand? I said, yes. He said, well, I'm looking for a senior second mate for the Commodore's ship. I said, oh, I said, would you like to take it? I said, oh, yes, please. And I said, when do you want me? He says, no. So there was a very hurried packing of bags. I got down to London. They had laid on a taxi for the train. And I drove very fast to Tilbury, went up the gangway. Shipping master was there to sign me on the Articles of Agreement. That was duly done. He walked down there and we cast off the lines and sailed for, as I thought, New Zealand. But it was a normal company run, U.S. Gulf to Australasia, it was called. And I found that when we got to the U.S. Gulf, that we weren't actually going to New Zealand, we were going to Australia. So the navigator got the wrong ship. So that's the very basics of it, yeah.
What made you choose New Zealand then?
I had the post-war years, I was a very free agent, I had no bonds to do shipping companies. I'd served my apprenticeship with Ardrossan, a line called the Barron Line, Hugh Hogarth Barron Line, and I had no particular wish to go back to them, but we had a merchant navy pool, and you went to the office of pool and director and said, I'm looking for a ship, what can you give me? And they offered you various ships. And I had gone to, where was it? I had to think where it was. I'd gone to ship and was given this job as second mate of a Liberty ship. And I'd never sailed on a Liberty ship before. It was a good experience. We went down to West African ports, came back to the UK, and the skipper, the ship was Peter Stewart. He came from Lossiemouth. And this was his first command and my first job as second mate, and we got on swimmingly. This really, really good friendship. So he said, what are you going to do? And I said, I haven't made any plans. He said, well, this company is going to buy the ship and she's going to be renamed Cora Bank. And he said, we'll be going out to the Australasian run. And I said, yeah, you go out to New Zealand? He said, oh yes, Australia, New Zealand. I said, you know, I've got two aunts in New Zealand I've never ever met. They were First World War brides. Married two Scots who'd settled in New Zealand. And I said, I'd love to meet up with them. And that initially was what brought me to New Zealand.
The fact that you had family
here. And they had kept in touch over the years with their mother and with my mother, who's their sister, of course. And it was a very wonderful occasion to meet with them when I first came out. Now, that was 1947. And I wasn't at all impressed by New Zealand, at Auckland particularly. To me, it seemed a very laid-back town. I couldn't get over the verandas over the shop fronts. The tram cards had been thrown out of Glasgow, I think, about 1909 or 1910. And these enormously wide-brimmed felt hats that the men wear. And the women, well, I've no guide to women's dresses, but they all looked rather antiquated, old-fashioned. So I had a mental picture that was way, way behind the times. And it was quite some number of visits later before I began to really like the place and appreciate the people, who are a wonderful people to work with and be part of these days. So that is the basic scale of that.
So you decided on New Zealand then, rather than Australia?
Yes,
or?
So I had gone on a ship, one called the Hazel Bank. I joined her in Cardiff. We sailed away from there. We did, went out to came out to New Zealand, I think it was, and did a few trips around the Pacific, did this, did that. And we were in Australia loading grain for Madras, but at a little place called Port Lincoln on the Spencer Gulf. And the captain of the ship said for me, and he said, would you be willing to transfer? And he explained that there was a ship in Melbourne and the captain of the ship had his wife aboard and she'd taken very ill, not expected to live, and he wanted to be relieved. So the five ships were involved in playing musical chairs. So I finished up going back to away from Port Lincoln by this time, going back to Port Lincoln to join another one called the Titan Bank, another Liberty boat. And I was on her for, I think it was away for about 3.5 years from Scotland.
That's a long
time. So it's a long way to go away, and that's what sort of makes me say I've grown away from it there. But one of the ports we called into that Titan Bank trip was the was Dunedin in New Zealand. I'd never been here before, and as I mentioned earlier, I've had a lifelong interest in the Scout movement, and I was at that in a part of a branch called the Deep Sea Rover Scouts. People with bought lads who, like myself, had gone to sea after being involved in scouting, became part of the sea-going branch, Royal and Merchant Navy. And I had seen some wonderful scouting in my years at sea, really wonderful. And the first night in Dunedin, I made contact with the scout people here and was invited to a meeting that night. And it was very good, and I was introduced to a lady that night, and we seemed to click off quite well, and in fact she became the love of my life. we were here in actually the 1951 war strike, still spoken very seriously about in New Zealand, a very traumatic experience for a lot of people. It lasted for many months, and we were here in Dunedin for many, many weeks. And of course, there's no work to be done, no nothing. And my wife-to-be at that stage was a supervisor at the old Banyule telephone exchanges. Mm-hmm. Look after a bunch of girls in the telephone exchange. And she had a lot of off-duty time, mm-hmm. so had I. And I was treated a lot of the leading places, going to here, did this, did that. Mm-hmm. My family made me very, very welcome. Mm-hmm. And her brother and her mum and dad had all been involved in Scout movement. Mm-hmm. So the upshot was that I went away from Dunedin, rejoined the world of shipping, mm-hmm. went around the world again. I think we did four times right around the world. And eventually got back, and then that was September 1941. I mentioned mm-hmm. getting home, mm-hmm. my mother's wanting me to stay till Christmas, and eventually getting out here. And I can remember that I arrived in New Zealand on the 5th of April 1952. Mm-hmm. And it was an auspicious day for me because the centennial of my old school in Paisley, the John Nielsen Institution in Paisley. Uh-huh. This was their centennial. Uh-huh. And I was always sorry I didn't make the centennial. Uh-huh. Uh-huh. But however, that brings you up to date so far.
When you were coming back that time, you were coming back again.
Yes.
To see your...
Coming back,
the woman who's going to be your wife.
Yes, yes. Uh-huh.
So there was an incentive. There was an incentive.
Oh, very, very much so. And you know, we decided there that I had no real thoughts of settling down at any time during my career. I'd again with a few ladies, but never anything terribly serious, and this one was very serious.
And your wife was a New Zealander?
Yes, she was a New Zealander. Her folks came from Airdrie. Uh-huh. Her grandmother uh-huh. came from Airdrie uh-huh. and had come out here in the 1870s as a hired help job to come mm-hmm. to one here mm-hmm. in Dunedin in the old sailing ship days. Mm. She had a very, so my wife had a strong Scottish background, songs mm-hmm. and story mm-hmm. and the like. Mm-hmm. So I came back and was settled in quite readily.
Mm-hmm. And did you get married here?
Yes. Mm-hmm. I were married here in Knox Church in mm-hmm. Dunedin. Mm-hmm. And our daughter was christened there, and our daughter was married there. Mm-hmm. So came all the way from London back to Dunedin to get married.
Mm. Uh-huh. Well, that's how it
should
be.
English husband with her too. Uh-huh.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Well, that's fortunate.
Yes.
Could we go back to when did your family move to Paisley, Stan?
I'm not quite sure. We were in Perth, I believe, until I was about two. I never inquired very deeply. But we went back to Paisley and had to change departments, mm-hmm. went to Inland Revenue, and accommodation was a problem even mm-hmm. then in Scotland. Mm-hmm. And we got accommodation in a little village about, what would it be, 6 or 7 miles mm-hmm. out of Paisley, mm-hmm. a little place called Georgetown, mm-hmm. which had been a munitions factory mm-hmm. in World War I. Uh-huh, uh-huh. And Lloyd George, of course, Minister of Munitions, mm-hmm. the place was called Georgetown. Mm-hmm. And what they'd done, they put rows of wooden houses, Canadian-built houses, to create this village for the workers. Uh-huh, uh-huh. And, of course, the place had been closed down completely. Mm-hmm. It had been built as a forestry compound, about mm-hmm. 5 square miles mm-hmm. of pine forest. And it was a walk to the station in the morning to go to school, mm-hmm. a train to Paisley, then a half-mile walk up mm-hmm. to the, up the Bray, mm-hmm. Stony Bray, to the John Nielsen School mm-hmm. in Paisley. Mm-hmm. And I was at John Nielsen from 1934 till 1942. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I sat my hires in 1942 mm-hmm. and was very, very keen to become a vet. Very keen to become a vet. But places were hard to come by. Mm-hmm. And then I discovered that the veterinary's course was a reserved occupation mm-hmm. and I wouldn't be able to join service or do anything. So my good friend at school, one of my best friends at school, a few months earlier had joined the New Zealand Shipping Company, had come out here as a cadet and gone home, and I met up with him, and he was very, very enthusiastic about the seagoing career. So I broached it with my father, and my father had gone to school with the Hogarths in Drossen, and so the upshot was I was indentured for my 4 years of service to Hungry Hogarth, mm-hmm. They were called H.H.
Did you see your father was a civil servant?
Yes, civil servant. And he had to retire early. He had damaged an eye in First World War, went blind in that one, and also a further blow to the other eye made him blind, so he left the service there and was blind for, I can't think how long it was, but he made light of blindness and learned Braille. He was a good public speaker, and he would speak at functions and talk to people about being blind, and they please treat us normally. We're not any different from anybody else, but we just can't see you, we can hear you, and do this and do that.
And you say he learned Braille?
He learned Braille and became very involved with the Talking Book Service, and did, I think, did a lot for the blind.
Did he manage to carry on working?
No, he didn't. He had to retire at that stage. And when he came out here, he became involved again with the blind, Blind Institute.
He came to New Zealand.
We brought them out to New Zealand. I think it was about, what year would that be? I can't just remember the exact year. 1960, something like that, the early 50s, 60s. And he became involved with the Blind Institute and did a lot of good work for them. A lot of good. And so was quite a busy fellow in the community, despite his blindness.
Sounds like it, doesn't it? Who would you say was an influence on you becoming a reader in your early life?
Both my father and mother were great readers. And I lived in a house with a lot of books. Some of them were pretty flimsy, and I think back, I say that to The Wizard and The Beano and the various boyhood books, Hotspur and Rover and the like, all these books. I remember them so well and enjoyed reading them. But my father and my mother were great readers, and it was just a normal thing to do to sit down and read. So I was very early introduced to a lot of very interesting books.
Were you an only child then?
I was an only child, unfortunately. There was others, but one died, and that was all there was to it. So,
what do you recall of your mother reading
then? My mother, a lovely lady. She'd been a nurse in the First World War, and the, what was it, the FANY units, the Fringe Auxiliary Nursing Service. And she'd been involved in sick nursing a lot of men in up around Kirkintilloch way, in there. And she's a very placid type of lady, and a very lovely lady in herself. And I got on very well with both my parents. I was very lucky with them.
Now, what was her taste in reading then? What sort of thing
she
did
was
you like?
Probably the NES one, and the people's friend.
Yes.
I can remember them seeing my name, the first time I ever saw my name in print. I won a prize in some weird and wonderful competition, The People's Friend, and had my name printed on it.
Was that a writing competition?
No, it was just I can't remember what type of thing it was, but it was just a very simple business there.
Well, your mother would have been proud.
Oh, yes, very much so, very much so. And Dad.
Did you ever read The People's Friend yourself?
No, not really. And any of the others. Dad would get me onto a few of the better children's books, Valentine and some of the sea stories and some of the Daring Do's of pirates and the like. The good old cut and thrust of the pirate ship, that type of thing. So, but when I went to sea, we were very lucky. The old merchant ships had put on board the ships a collection of probably about 100 books. And these were part of the mission to seamen, the area for us to working with seamen. That was the Anglican Church, really, mission to seamen. And the books were always good sort of quality books. There was nothing too rubbishy. There was enough to cater for everyone. So you just worked your way steadily through these books, and that was it. And in ports throughout the world where there was a mission to seamen, your books were changed. So there were always books coming aboard. And my diaries, even looking back into the 40s and 50s, my diaries, I'm recorded very deeply engrossed in such and such a book. Mm. Must finish it today. You know, that kind of thing that I read a lot. The nature of the thing was we were long hauled between ports usually. The longest was usually about between Panama and Auckland. That was 29 mm-hmm. days. Mm-hmm. Now, you work 8 hours, 2 or 4 hour watches mm-hmm. in the day. Mm-hmm. The rest of the time is your own, mm-hmm. apart from a few duties mm-hmm. you had to do here and there, navigation-wise. But by and large, you settled into a book and you just loved reading.
Mm. So you got spare time then?
Yes, well, plenty of spare time mm-hmm. In the post-war years. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. We were 4 hours on and 4 hours off mm-hmm. during the war years, and it was hard going, mm-hmm. very hard working, etc. But as you rose up through the ranks, it became easier, and mm-hmm. you...
Was that the main means of recreation then?
Yes, reading is to some degree. Mm-hmm. For instance, radio was almost unknown and then. Mm-hmm. You're getting out into the midst of the ocean now, you can't tune into a Scottish station in the middle of the Pacific. So the only way you were going to get any radio contact was through a special maritime radio. Mm. And I remember one brand that was sold in the United States, and that was Hallicrafters. Mm. And a Hallicrafters set was a box set, metal case, and in most parts of the world you could pick up something, local mm-hmm. or even distant there. Mm. But the old turntable gramophone was another one. Mm-hmm. At the end of a day's work, between 6 to 8 at night, you find that a cargo ship, a lot of the crew would assemble a number 4 hatch. Mm-hmm. And just have a quiet day, the ships were dry, no drink, no nothing. Mm-hmm. But you'd have the gramophone there, mm-hmm. and inevitably somebody produced a guitar, mm-hmm. and you'd sing away some of the old Scott song, or do this or do that. So it was always a companionable hour, that the dog watch, second dog watch.
Was it a good representation of Scots on the merchant ship?
Yes, they always were good Scots reputation. Mm. I sailed the Indian crews for a long time and greatly admired them. Mm. They were very wonderful people, all from Chittagong. Mm. And I was very fortunate in my early days. The chief officer said, you will learn to speak their language, boy. And I managed to get a good spattering of Hindustani, or Kulibat, I thought it was a form of Hindustani, the Kulibat. Mm-hmm. But occasionally phrases still crop up, and you think, oh, Jabada Kabada. Oh. Now the wee little phrases come up here.
Oh, what does that mean?
It means watch out.
Oh, very useful to know. The songs that you would sing then would... other nationalities join in with the Scottish
Yes, this is right. Mm-hmm. Can I take a wee break here?
Sure,
because
I'll
get a little book of songs. Well, I mentioned scouting a little while ago, mm-hmm. and scouting was very kind to me. My father had been a scout, was very keen that I join the movement, and there was only one other lad in the village who was a member of scouting. That this, to remember, was the Depression years when everything was very, very difficult. And this lad was the assistant scoutmaster. So he took me in each Friday night. We went in by train and got on a tram car and went to the Old Hall Scouts, a suburb of Paisley. And I have a great deal to thank them for, because it opened a new world with the badges to gain, in different interests, camping, outdoors, and I just loved the whole thing over there. And one of the things, I'm talking badges, and when I read this little book was made for my actual bookbinder's badge. Now that's going back to the 1930s, that little book. And you mentioned the songs, and I've got a lot of different songs in here, and the old Scots ones. So So goodbye, Mary dear, I'm sorry I'm leaving you. Although this parting grieves me, I'll never pour untrue. So cheer up, my darling, and don't look so forlorn. Cheer up, Mary dear, we're bound for Cape, around Cape Horn. And also, so that was the kind of songs we would sing. And I've kept that as a souvenir for my grandchildren.
These were the kind of, you sang these in the Scouts?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
In all sorts of things there. And I loved every minute of it there.
And so for the bookbinding badge,
I got that. I earned badges on a lot of the things there. Mm-hmm. And to this day, I'm still able to use a lot of those skills.
Mm-hmm.
They were probably childish little things in themselves, but being able to do that was something very, very wonderful. Mm.
There's one here called On Mother's Knee.
Yes, all the dreary songs. You had a weepy song at those sessions. It was always a Bonnie Strathire, you know that kind of thing.
And we've got The Road to the Isles here.
The Road to the Isles, yes. Mm-hmm.
And the Welsh National Anthem, Stan.
Yes, Mae'n Heimlad Fanada. You met a little lady in Wales, and we corresponded. I've met a lot of girls over the years. And she was Tedville Evans, and she came from the Rhondda Valley, and she taught me the Welsh National Anthem.
And what age were you
I'd be 17, 16, 17, you know, that kind of thing.
So you have it in Welsh here, and in English translation.
Yeah.
Westeringholm.
Yes.
I've got a picture of you singing that.
Have you?
In my mind's eye.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And We'll Gather Lilacs.
We'll Gather Lilacs, that came from...
That'd be First World War.
Oh, you know, we would say post-World War. We'll Gather Lilacs, that was... I'm trying to think of it. It was one of the early musicals.
Mm-hmm.
I can't recall the author, the writer.
Mm-hmm. And there's one here in French.
Chatondré?
Yes, Chatondré. Did you learn French
at school? Yes, I had 5 years, and I did higher French from the high leaving certificate, and was able to keep this up, and I've still kept it up, because both my granddaughters have learned French from 5 years old.
Mm.
So granddad occasionally has a little chat with them on the phone in French and to get them giggling.
Uh-huh.
But granddad's funny way of saying things.
That's marvellous that you remember it, though. I mean, looking back now, what do you think about your education in Scotland?
I think I was very lucky to have the education. Times were hard, but there was a fee-paying school, and it was a strain for parents and so forth. But I was very, very lucky.
Mm.
I was given a very good education, despite the fact I didn't know it at the time.
Mm-hmm.
But, so I've been at pains to do the same for my children, and that's it.
And do you think they fared as well?
Yes, they have done, and they have also carried on with the hobbies of their parents into fancy needlework and things like that. My lad with his carpentry tools and so forth. They've used all the skills, they've kept them going, and that's good.
The model of education in New Zealand, it's quite like Scotland.
It is to some degree, but I'm beginning to be very, very critical now, after all these years, of the time spent in sport. If I go back to my own school days, yes, there was sport. We played football, soccer, between 4 o'clock to 5 o'clock every Thursday afternoon, away from the school, and I was goalie, and all I did was lean against the goalposts. It never ever, it tries to be worried about the thing, was never a great football fan.
Right, so you didn't have a team that you
no,
supported?
No. Mm-hmm. But again, I was lucky getting on, and then of course having to study for that, and I carried on the learning process. Mm-hmm. I've been able to go and do this, that and the next thing.
You certainly have.
Yes, I went back to reread French, I did a year of advanced French, but the granddaughters were growing up, so that I could, get back to conversing there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we were talking.
What age were you when you left school?
When I left school, just it's coming up 16.
16.
Yeah, yeah.
And you went straight to.
Went straight to sea. Yes, mm-hmm. yes, yes. Mm-hmm. I had a say planned for veterinary college. Mm-hmm. The hires were take was set early in the year from mm-hmm. memory. Would it be February, March period? The exam results didn't come out until June, July.
Yes, that happened.
Well, this was a hiatus mm-hmm. period where mm-hmm. you're just not doing anything. Some of the boys had left. We were down to small mm-hmm. class mm-hmm. by the time we finished. Yeah. It's fairly small classes mm-hmm. all the mm-hmm. way there. But anyway, I had nothing planned other than, yes, I wanted to go to vet college. Mm-hmm. I'd study the literature, the enrolments, etc. Mm-hmm. But they finished the C1 mm-hmm. and it was all done very, very quickly. Mm-hmm. My father got in touch with the Hogarths and yes, up for interview, yes, very happy. Come, there's the list of clothing you'll need and mm-hmm. come up and sign your things. The indentures are framed on the wall mm-hmm. in there. Not to frequent ill houses or houses of ill repute, mm-hmm. except on his master's business. Right, however, that was that.
Then your education in Scotland then, what kind of introduction did you get through that to reading?
Reading, I was very, very fortunate that my 5 years of secondary education, I had some wonderful teachers. I look back to them. One man particularly, David Livingston, strangely enough for a teacher, he was a master's in English and English and history. Those were the subjects. Mm-hmm. And he instilled in me, at any rate, a love of history, not just the dates per mm-hmm. se, the events rather than the tableau that unfolded from the events. Mm-hmm. But he was also a very good poet. Mm-hmm. He loved poetry, and it was he who instilled the love of poetry. Mm-hmm. And
that stayed with you, hasn't it?
It stayed with me all of the years through, mm-hmm. and I've got that to thank for. Mm-hmm. And particularly Burns. Mm-hmm. I can remember that the fifth year we studied Burns almost ad nauseum. But, you know, we got to know Burns and Burns's work and why and wherefore, without being critical. There's
and
so
it
much
didn't
criticism.
Put you off.
No, the poems themselves, there's an old saying here in Dunedin, when the early settlers came out, the first settlers came out in 1848, and subsequently mm-hmm. more and more settlers came out. Mm. But there's an old saying that every settler had two books in his kist, mm-hmm. his wooden kist. Mm-hmm. One was the Bible and the other was a copy of the works of Robert Burns. Mm-hmm. Now, whether that's true or not, I don't know, but I would suspect it's mm-hmm. fairly true. Mm-hmm. of the books that came mm-hmm. to New Zealand with mm-hmm. the settlers. Mm-hmm. They were a very practical bunch of people. Mm-hmm. Book reading was not perhaps mm-hmm. part of the establishment. Mm-hmm. That was to come later with mm-hmm. the Carnegies and all those other mm-hmm. people.
That you, as a lover of poetry, I see you have Burns on your
yes.
Oh,
yes. shelves. Yes, yes, yes. I have a lot of books for Burns. I've studied Burns and
Were those ones you brought with you?
No, I didn't. I only carried two books during the war. Mm. The Bible, copy of New Testament, copy of Burns. The only thing could have been one flash of a torpedo and you had lost everything. Mm-hmm. If not your life, full everything. Mm-hmm. So you didn't take anything valuable. Mm-hmm. And that was it. My father said, he gave me a copy of Burns. Uh-huh. And he was a very great Burnsian.
Right. Uh-huh.
There.
Uh-huh.
And I don't know if you've ever heard of a man, Harold L. Whiteman.
No, I haven't.
You haven't? Well, he was probably the voice of Scotland, as far as Burns was concerned. He was from Salkotes. Mm-hmm. He was a noted amateur artist mm-hmm. on stage, mm-hmm. And he's had a wonderful Scots voice. Mm-hmm. And later on I'll show you one of the old praying record. Mm-hmm. The name crops up here, Kenneth McKellar.
Yes.
Ken was a year behind me at school, I just remember him as a young fellow. I knew his older brother better, and that was it. But I've caught up with Ken as he's come out here over the years and so forth. Mm-hmm. In fact, we traced that there were 5 ex-Nielsonians in New Zealand. Mm-hmm. So we're keeping the country going.
Now, one of the questions I was going to ask you was whether or not, as well as the library of books that you had access to at sea, if you had brought books with you.
Oh, yes, you took books with you.
But not during the war?
Not during the war, no.
Right.
The influence during the war was just you just didn't take anything of any value.
But you had Burns and you had...
I had Burns, a copy of Burns and the Bible, and the New Testament, which my old aunt gave me. And that was it.
Were your family quite religious then?
No, not really. I was born and brought up in the Anglican Church, baptised in the Anglican Church.
Really?
Uh-huh. My father was he used to call it a lapsed Presbyterian. Mm-hmm. Mother was Anglican, I was brought up Anglican. Mm-hmm. And I went over to Presbyterianism when I married. So this was the thing to do.
Now that's interesting.
Yes, that happened here. Yes, yes, yes. Mm-hmm. And we're talking books of influence. I've got this one I just reach for. Mm-hmm. Have you ever heard of the author of that?
It's called Two Little Savages and it's by Ernest Thompson Seton, the author of Wild Animals I Have Known, Life of Game Animals. And this is quite old, but it's still got its dust cover. How long have you had this, Dan?
Not very long. I tried my whole life to buy one. Uh-huh. And I got that in a second-hand book sale closing down 5 or 6 years ago. Mm-hmm.
Now, why did you want to buy this?
This is a book that originally I'd gone up to senior scouting level mm-hmm. and was very keen on outdoors. Mm-hmm. And in the 1930s, I was under another influence. Mm-hmm. Do you ever know the name Grey Owl?
Oh, yes. Uh-huh.
You know Grey Owl, Washakwan Asin.
Uh-huh.
Now, Grio was preaching his conservative views of the beaver and so forth, and I can remember going to a lecture by Grio in the Paisley Town Hall and being greatly influenced by this man and his beavers.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I was very interested in life, the living animal was living next to the forest. Mm-hmm. My father used to reckon I knew every fox by its first name, and the rabbits were their second name, but there was rabbits, there was birds, there was plenty of wildlife around, and I became very interested in the wildlife, and I could comfortably spend hours sitting watching a fox vixen with her cubs.
Mm-hmm. So this was
an American book on the same kind of subject, the story of two boys who live in the primitive life on early settled New Zealand, America, and their desire to live like the Indian. Now, this is what the book is about living by the Indian, and we tried that, we practiced that, we did this, we did that, and it was a wonderful introduction.
And what sort of age was that when you first got your hands on this one? Because the original publication of this book is 1903, although this is a later edition from 1959, and it's published in London.
In London, yes.
So someone must have brought this over to New Zealand.
Like it greatly interests me, and I've always wanted a copy, and I was thrilled to get it. Mm-hmm. And I've read it since then several times, and the same feeling of warmth and awe comes over when I read that book, and I think back to those days when we learned to live like the Indian, be part of the outdoors. Mm-hmm. And this can happen when you're an only child sometimes. You'll make your own fun, your own interests and so forth, and I was just interested in the outdoors.
Mm-hmm. Where did you get the first copy of this?
I got this here in Dunedin, and it was one of the scout boys had a copy of it, it just went round.
Oh, right, everybody. You borrowed it.
It was borrowed there. And there was a copy, I think, in Paisley Library, and that was it. But I tried to buy a copy for years, was never able to do so.
Now, you mentioned Paisley Library there, and you anticipated what I was going to ask you, which was whether or not you used the public libraries in Scotland.
I'd used the public libraries since in school days, very much so. And then in seagoing days, no, it was just a case of what I might have picked up in the bookshop, the bookshop and the station or something like that. You just picked up a book, you read it, that was it.
You had the seagoing library.
Yeah, the seagoing library. And you carried your own. I had one or two favourites. And again, poetry. I like my poetry even then. So I'd get into other poets. I also love Palgrave's Golden Treasury.
Yes.
It was delightful.
Did you own that?
Oh, yes, yes. And I've since continued to buy poetry. I can't resist buying an old book of poetry. And I'm very thrilled that my two granddaughters are very much into poetry. They're both into this. So I've been able to give them little books of New Zealand poetry. And this is good, giving the wee bit of feeling.
Because so, they have dual
nationalities,
there.
These youngsters. And I'm sure they'll come to live here at some stage in their lives.
Now, if you go back in your mind to Paisley Library, can you remember any particularly favourite texts from the years that you used that?
Not really. As I said, there was... I was willing to read anything. Novels, no. No, I would read them and then sort of groan a bit and said, oh, so thank goodness that's over. And that is still true today.
Right, so you're a non-fiction reader.
I'm a non-fiction reader. Though again, I've just read All Things Bright and Beautiful, the vet, the Yorkshire vet, still attracts.
James Herriot.
And during seagoing days, the Reader's Digest played a very large part in your life because always heaps of Reader's Digest coming as part of a ship to exchange library. So you became almost inured to the American way of saying things, their spelling, and some of the, what were to you, were very peculiar ideas. But you became inured to that thing and probably influenced to a fair degree too.
Now, how did they arrive on board?
Well, they came as part of the school, the library exchange. And magazines came with it too. So you got a whole heap of carton after carton of books that Patry would bring down in his van, and he'd get the cadets to bring them aboard and could take the other ones back and things like that.
So did you indulge in fiction then when you were at sea?
Fiction, no, not to any great extent. I think of the Maltese Falcon. I wasn't greatly into crime, though I loved Agatha Christie, some of Agatha Christie's. And I'm trying to think of the... There was no great... Oh, the Edgar Wallace, of course, the crime as a writer, they were ones. And, of course, through boyhood and even into adulthood, and I still enjoy Robert Louis Stevenson, very, very much so. And I can remember early marriage years buying a complete set, I think, of 22 volumes of Scott's The Bottle Minstrelsy.
Have you read them all?
Yeah, Stan? I had read them all, and I reread them all, and I can remember telling them stories of them to the children, my children who were growing up.
Did you read them as a child too, as a young man?
Yes, as a young man. You've influenced with that.
And where would you have?
That was from library. Library. We had a small school library, but it was. Oh, it was well used. You know, you had your own favourites in that one there.
And what was your favourite?
Probably Scottish history in those days. The influence of the Walter Scott's writings, which of course are very much a part of Scottish history, aren't they? Even though we can't always be sure how truthful they are. I recently read a book that brought me back, Myth and Fiction, the Scottish... Now, I can't remember the author, I can't remember the exact title, but this was a very learned gentleman who, he was Bill Brown by name or something, but it turned out he was Lord somebody or other in private life, and one of the border families, and he had extensively researched the myth of some of the myths of Scottish history, and said that some of them definitely were myths that did not occur. And others, well, there was yes, there was a reason, etc., etc. That's only just been published last year, that book.
There's been some television programmes recently in the UK about Scottish history.
Yes.
Have you had them here?
Not really. Not really. This was a favourite. I haven't managed to read the others in the series.
Now, this one's called On the Trail of Robert the Bruce.
Yes, yeah, yeah.
And it's by David R. Ross.
Yeah. Have you read that yourself?
And it's published in Edinburgh. I haven't read that.
Well, it's worth reading.
Published in 1999.
Yeah.
And
what he does...
You got that over here, then?
Yes, yes,
Where do you buy books here?
Lots of good bookshops here. And I was in, a lot of my time was spent in there were booksellers as well, book printers, publishers, but there were also printers and stationers and that. I had about 20 odd years with them. I got involved first when I came ashore with a stevedoring, one with Shaw Saddle and Albion, but I found that the time spent at work was quite... frightening. Times never saw my son awake for weeks on end, the way I was working long hours. Then I just joined this company called Cools, some of Wilkie, who were the country's top printers.
And where were they based?
They were based in Dunedin here and had factories right through the country. And after I'd been with them, I went into them as a salesman. My job was to go around and always wearing a hat and a suit and say, good morning, Mr. Smith, my name is so-and-so, I'm from so-and-so. Can we assist you with anything? We are printing or stationery, anything like that. And they were the country's top printers.
When did you start working for them?
I started working for them about 55. And they greatly influenced me. They're a rock-solid company. Very, very highly regarded in the country. They printed every single thing you could imagine, from these plastics here to books to the butter wrappers, to the ice cream wrappers, to anything you like to name printed. They did it. All the cigarette packs, cigarette cards, greeting cards. There was a factory somewhere doing it. There was 11 units of the company. And I'd been with them about 2.5 years, and the managing director sat me for one day and said, "Down, Stan." I said, "What have I done wrong?" And he said, "We've been watching you." He said, "Would you like to take the opportunity to open a branch for us?" And I said, "I'll Google this." And I said, "What's the story?" He said, "We want to open a branch in Invercargill, and we'd like you to take on the job." Well, this was just completely out of the blue. So that's what I did. I went to Invercargill, and I had 9 years down there, and I became the top branch of the country. I then went to Hamilton, did the same thing again. Then just fell out with them over procedures, which we both thought were childish when we made up a year or two after. I left them and came back to head for a company here called Williamson Jeffrey Limited, who were the top manufacturing stationers in the country. And I became national stationery manager for them, marketing manager and export manager, you name it. I headed the whole division, the major division there, 400 staff and nine units around the country, five subsidiaries. So I had five subsidiaries to worry about as well as four branches. But it was good experience.
You've had an interesting career.
Well, I've always been lucky the type of job. I've enjoyed working, you know, in that. What they didn't tell me was that they were badly in the red, and I had been for many years. But in 5 years, I put them back in the black again. But it nearly cost me my health, my marriage, my home, everything. Just, you know, you just got to go. I've got to go and do this and do that. And I took sat down one night and thought, well, you're not going to live very long if you carry this on. And at that stage, I wrote my resignation out that night. Sat down.
Well, you retired then?
No, I retired.
What age were you when you retired?
I retired first at 59. And I did work for a year or two. I just had to get back and kill you and kill again. Then I started to take odd jobs here, odd jobs there. And finish up with, I was doing working for six different companies one day. And making three or four times what I'd done as a senior executive. There you are, you know, this was it. But I enjoyed it, you know.
So you gave up the sea then when you came here and
yes,
got married?
Yes, I did to some degree, but when I came back to, I went with Hamilton, then Hamilton publicity officer, city council fellow, he came to me, he said, would you like to take on a job for me? I said, oh, what's that? And he said, I've been running a little class with about basic navigation and so forth for the yacht club here. He said, but I'm leaving, I'm going so-and-so. Would you take it on? So I said, oh, yes. So, you know, I started the thing. He didn't tell me it was 66 students in one small class and that they had so many big yachts, motorboats, etc., etc. And I finished up running it under the auspices of the external unit of Auckland University. And I used Hamilton University, which was the only building then, and I got to know them very well in there, and I was supplying them with a lot of work, printing work, and doing stationery, furniture, and goodness knows what. But anyway, I took that on, and I quite enjoyed doing it, and it was quite successful. But I came back to Dunedin here, and I'd only been back a week, my phone rang, and this is a fellow, Captain Mike Paddy, here, and he'd just arrived from New Zealand Shipping Company, chief officer there, and he'd been appointed head to start the School of Nautical Studies here at the Polytechnic. And I found myself as the first part-time tutor. And I carried that on for 25, 30 years.
So you were doing that whilst you were working?
I was doing that while I was working, at night, doing this there. And I enjoyed it.
No wonder you were overworked.
Well, you know, that was
it. Did you get much time to read for your own pleasure?
Yes, I read, I always read, yes. I had time to read, yes, I did.
Well, that's evidenced by lots of the books that you have in your house.
Yes, yes, it is, yeah.
Before I move on to ask you about them, Stan, could I just ask about your wartime experience and, you know, what that was like? Whether you spent any time reading that Bible when you were...
Yes. Funnily enough, it was just last Sunday with down at Port Chambers. There was a church service, a Merchant Navy Association's annual church service. And the ministers, Reverend John Sinclair, John and I got to know each other very well over the years, and the previous year I'd given him a poem about Merchant Navy, and he had used that at the church service, so I wasn't able to go this year. But anyway, I thought, well, I'll ring John and see if he needs any help. So John said, no, I'll come up and see you. So he came up, and that was last week. And I got one of those books out there, and I thought, there's bits in here you might be able to use, John. I said, alternatively, I had a little book, a little notebook like this type of thing, here, and I said, I've got a right at the back here, it's by a poem by a fellow called Gilbert Franco. And he'd written the poem during war, give us the ships, we need these ships to win the war. And there was truth in that, because in 1942, the ship losses had grown so alarmingly, it was outstripping the capacity to build. Everything was, so it was a very, very distinct gap. And we were nearer losing the war than ever in that 1942 period there. So anyway, John said, can I use this? I said, yeah, take the thing there. But what I had forgotten was that this is a diary of my first voyage to sea. So John rang me last night and he said, I hope you didn't mind, but I used your diary as well as the poem. And I said, how'd it go, John? He said, very good, thanks to you. And I said, okay. So I kept the diary for my parents, very boyish, anyway. It was a traumatic experience, that first voyage, because I hadn't thought much about it, known much about it. You don't think of consequences or anywhere. But we left the Clyde on a 43 ship convoy with an under-trained and understaffed escort of Canadian vessels. We got out on Christmas Day 1942, passed quite peacefully convoy. But the next day, Dornitz had gathered the largest concentration of U-boats of the war to date at that stage. And we lost 15 ships next week and over 500 men. And
how did you get news of how the war was going generally then, when you were so far out at sea and living with such stress?
You knew nothing about it. You knew nothing about it. All you got was a little handwritten page with some football results or some of this. And I remember in the book as one, I put a wee page like this over a message by Darlene, today was assassinated so-and-so. This we thing. And this, the wireless operator put this, and it was just circulated around here, and you wanted to read it. That was your newspaper. And you might get that once a week. That was all.
And you'd be away for long periods of time then,
yes,
I imagine.
Yes, I was away for about 9 months that time. We're carrying a Russian convoy cargo to the US, the Persian Gulf. And as I say, it was a, so I had actually put my thoughts down on that one, and the very boyish, and anyway, but
and there would be no letters then either, Stan. Letters, I
no,
imagine.
No, the mail just sort of, you know, you were lucky if you got it. But that was it. So there's little John said you'd bring it back this week, and so you might get a look at that before you go back.
Yes,
and see. But this is another one, and this again is.
Stan's just given me a notebook. Your name's on the inside, and there's a list of
ships I sailed on. These are all the places I visited during my years at sea.
Yes, a complete record. I'm just looking at here, you arrived in Singapore Friday the 18th of August 1950. Arrived Penang Saturday the 26th of August. You certainly got around, didn't you?
Well, around the World Service, you see. So you rode Far East for US Atlantic Coast, Boston, New York, Philadelphia, Baltimore, then down to Galveston, Houston, and Texas ports, up the Mississippi to New Orleans.
You mentioned the Reader's Digest, singularly. Any other books that you remember coming across unexpectedly when you were at sea in these libraries that you enjoyed?
Not really. Reader's Digest was something that proliferated. You never seemed to see the end of Reader's Digest. And some of it was quite good, it was interesting. But there's no doubt it probably influenced our thinking in many, many ways, a way of doing things.
Did you get fed up with the same things?
No, you weren't. You weren't consciously finding fault. I was a reader those days. You were reading for your interest, and you'd give a wee sort of sigh at the finish of the book and say, well, thank goodness, that's finished. But then they are, by the same token, the next two or three, so, gosh, I wonder if this fellow read it anymore. That was good. I enjoyed that. Can I do a bit more, et cetera, et cetera?
Who would have fitted into that category for you?
Probably the, your influence, the way you thought about things. That's an American way, and there's the rest of the world way of doing it.
Mm.
But you learn some of the American ways of doing the things there. You learn, first of all, that the spelling was different.
Mm.
That was your first thing you noticed. Mm-hmm. You thought, these people can't spell. But then it went on, you see, from here.
Uh-huh. Now, after you settled here in Dunedin, and you had a little bit of travelling around New Zealand, I think.
Yes.
But you came back to Dunedin and made your home here.
Yes.
When did you buy this house, by the way?
We came back from Hamilton, right off of the fence here, to Head Williams and Jeffries in 1968.
Mm.
And we built a new house in Hamilton, and it was a very nice home. And our wife was very much in love with our new house and so forth. And we looked around here, we had to get the children back to school. Mm-hmm. Rob was fifth form, Jan was still intermediate at that stage. Yes, 1968, I came back here, and we looked and looked and looked and couldn't just see anything. And I spotted this in the paper one morning and took Tisha at the car, came up here with the agent, had a look at it, went away, thought about it, and I thought, yes, I could do something with that. Now, when my wife saw it, she nearly had kittens. It had been... squatters had been in.
Mm-hmm.
It was derelict.
Mm-hmm.
Broken windows. Mm-hmm. It was just a mess. So, where to go?
Mm-hmm.
Look in there.
I should say that this is quite a historic house.
It is too.
Tell us about it.
Well, the house was built in 1860s, 66, 67. For the Reverend Dr. Thomas Burns, who was a nephew of Robert Burns, our poet. Now, the house has had a long and checkered career. It's a large house, and it was always known as the Big House on the Hill.
Yes.
Originally, it came with when it was on its own, with 121 acres of land here. And the Arthur Burns, that was the Reverend Dr. Thomas's son, he had grown potatoes and wheat grain on here, and some of those potatoes were actually exported in the 70s to Sydney, Australia.
Right.
But over the years, we set to rebuild the house as it was. I was very fortunate. I had plenty of money and was able to do this. We let the builders live for about 3 months because my wife said, well, I'm not moving in there, and I could say I blamed her. So the house was this set and the next thing. And then over the years, the four of us, the children as well, mum kept the cups of tea and the soft drinks coming, but the children found that they could mix cement for Dad. They could carry this, they could do that, and it became their house as much as mine.
I'm just looking at a photograph album, which is a sort of evolution of this the reclamation
the children
of this house.
Cleared the whole of that area at the side there.
Now did you consult books at all?
We went to a lot of books and sort of said, will we do this, will we do that? There was a lot of discussion went on, but that was it. And today it's very, very much a restored home.
It's
very comfortable, and it, needless to say, it's worth an awful lot more than the money I paid for it.
I'll bet, yes. You said you like DIY.
Yes, and this was a very, very good way of letting off steam at the weekend.
Certainly did. Did you buy books or borrow books from anywhere?
Yes, I got the library and got books there and bought in. How do you do this? How do you do that? And basically, I had very little knowledge of do-it-yourselfing. But I was fortunate. A lot of very good friends who suffered me sometimes in silence and said, why I wanted to know how to do this, how to do that, etc., etc. And it went on and on and on from there.
Would you like me to pause now?
Yes, I'll go for a wee pause.